In one more last resort, I signed up at a temporary employment center. They placed me at $10 an hour at a small company, one of several in the area, that manufactured parts for the nearby General Motors plant. The temp agency placed most of the co-workers as well. The idea was that if you went in as a temp and if you proved yourself worthy and able, you were hired permanently. I didn't get quite that far. Among other things, this plant manufactured steel frames for minivan bucket seats. My job was to run a semi-automatic welding machine. Specifically, I stood in front of this mammoth machine and hit a foot switch to open a gate on the steel prep table. I would grab a pre-configured piece of tubular steel and set it in place. Then I would pick up another piece of tubular steel, set it in the opposite place, and finally take a mallet and bang the shit out of both of them to make sure they were properly seated. I would now take two more pieces of tubular steel, place them crosswise in the correct position, and once again bang the shit out of them to make sure they were seated properly. Then, with both hands, I would depress the parallel operating buttons, which in turn opened the gate on the prep table. The prep table would slide in, the gate would close, and the automatic welders would spot weld this pile of tubular steel in the proper places. In 30 seconds, the welding would stop, the gate would open, and the table would slide out. I had to take my mallet again and bang the shit out of the newly welded steel frame to set it free from its welding cradle. Then, with asbestos gloves, I would pick up this finished product and toss it in a huge steel basket behind me. I would do this again and again and again, all night long. I worked from 3 to 11. I learned a lot of things on my first night there. For starter, it ranked right up there with one of the worst jobs I ever had. The noise was deafening. It was physically demanding and incredibly boring. It was also a little dangerous. I have a scar on my left arm where one of the newly welded seat frames touched it. You know how sometimes when you burn yourself, you're not sure because the first sensation feels icy cold? It may take a nanosecond to realize you're frying. That's what this felt like. Whenever anyone asks me about the scar, I say it's from a knife wound inflicted while defending Julie's honor. I also have a small scar on my right hand. I use the same story. That scar I got while taking baby back ribs from the oven and hitting the top of my hand on the broiler coils. Thank God I had enough anesthetizing fluid in me when I did that. Otherwise, it would have really hurt. The employees worked in tandem on this automatic welding machine. I worked on the right, and a female ogre manned the left. Listening to this employee's nonstop bitching about how fucked up her fellow workers were gave me plenty of opportunity to feel miserable and lament the fact that I had never finished college. She ranted continuously on how she had to do all the work, how no one appreciated her, and if it was up to her, every one of them some bitches would be out on the street, especially that jerk Tom over there on the tow motor. "That was my goddamn job," she explained. The cumulative effect of this, plus standing on my feet for 8 hours a day, minus breaks, was that I lasted 2 weeks. This was not the first or last time I walked in the back door, greeting Julie with the news that A, I quit, B, I got fired, C, I was laid off, or D, I didn't get the job. At this point, I realized that my choices of jobs, strategy for survival, and overall attitude towards work were not sitting too well with her. Despite my always pulling my weight financially, it was becoming obvious to me that Julie really wished I could land something she considered respectable. So did I. I left the job in good standing and reported back to the agency. Someone there had finally taken a close look at my resume and decided I was being underutilized in these manual labor jobs. I could not have agreed more. The agency then sent me to interview for a decent position with another company in the same parts manufacturing conglomerate. I was to manage a tubular steel production shift. It was probably a good thing I didn't get the job. Chevy Malibus would have been falling apart all up and down the interstate. Next, the agency sent me to interview for a quality control manager in an electrostatic paint facility. In this position, I was to be responsible for monitoring the line that painted the left front wheel wells of the subcompact Vega, or something. I was excited. I thought I could spot a line of drip paint as well as the next guy. Perhaps there was more to it than that. I appeared clean-cut at the interview and thought I sounded intelligent while sharing my ideas on customer service, especially how it related to the success of this shop specifically and, of course, to all of General Motors. I still did not get the job. Next, I was sent to a company called Promotional Products. This opportunity took me beyond the General Motors companies. I was to interview not for a managerial position, but as a laborer. This was a company businesses would call if they wanted a name and a logo printed on a giveaway product. Little piggy banks with a financial company's name, combs promoting a hair salon, little plastic football sporting the team of a local or national team. In the interview, the general manager saw that I had extensive experience as a manager. Given that, it would be a waste of my talents to work as a printer on the first shift. I would be better suited as a manager of the operation's new second shift. I readily agreed. It took a week to train me on the promotional product printing machines. The woman who trained me, Connie, the day shift manager, was a humorless piece of work if I ever saw one. But since I would not be working with her, I didn't give it a second thought. Yet. We worked in an old Maytag factory in the north end of a semi-vacant industrial area of Mansfield. There may be thousands of small factories with interiors like this one, but I had never seen one. Imagine a Dickensian post-industrial six-floor bombed-out factory that hadn't been painted or remodeled in 50 years. Wires and cobwebs were hanging down, looped from the ceiling rafters and strung out all over the floor. Many of the windows were blacked out, some so dirty you couldn't see out of them. Many were boarded up, and quite a few were missing. The floors were wooden and warped. The storage in the lower level was freezing in the winter and sweltering in the summer because the rear corner of the building's roof was missing, just as if a bomb had really hit it. But since they offered me $25,000, the hell did I care? For the most part, everything was going just fine. I liked working second shift. Since Julie worked days and I worked evenings, our quality time was on the weekends. Because of its brevity, they, the weekends, were very pleasant. Also, Julie liked the independence she had during the week. From then on, I told prospective employers I preferred second shift. My second shift employees were a ragtag bunch. All of them were nice to be around, quick learners, and fairly hardworking. In addition to my management duties, I had to do some of the printing. I didn't mind. It took a little skill, was moderately tedious, but not excruciatingly boring. The ready-to-be-condemned condition of the building did not seem to hamper our production. I knew little or nothing about the business itself, but I figured that everything was fine. Unfortunately, the salesmen were not doing their job, or the trend for giving away cheap, useless shit was diminishing. Sales plummeted, and the second shift was disbanded. I had a choice. Be demoted and work for a shift under Connie, or get laid off. It was one thing to run into Connie for 15 minutes a day at the turn of the shift. It was quite another thing to work for her. I did not have the patience to go with the flow. I chose getting laid off. I walked in the back door in the middle of the evening and greeted Julie, who was in the throes of knitting. "Hi, honey. Guess what?" For a while, Julie was a good sport about my unique approach to survival. She and I never argued. In fact, we never said much about the things we probably should have. So, no fireworks. But I was out of work again and running low on options. I saw an ad in the paper for a second shift supervisor. I had no idea what the job entailed, but I instantly liked the hours. I called the number, got the address, made an appointment, and started adjusting one of my resumes. Lake Erie Frozen Foods is in Ashland, Ohio, 60 miles from Lake Erie. The name of the place made me think of fish. However, the only thing fishy about the place might have been the operations manager. I'll get into that later. The company produced a variety of frozen bread appetizers for restaurants and the food service industry, but no fish. The plant was open Monday through Friday. All these goodies were produced between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. They were looking for a supervisor for its second shift sanitation crew. Starting at 4 in the afternoon and working till 11, the crew was responsible for cleaning the entire plant, all the equipment, and then staging the ingredients for the following day. The plant had to be USDA ready every day. My experience was such that I was a prime candidate for this position. After all, I was a tidy man and a former supervisor, and my resume said I was detail-oriented. Plus, I loved food and cooking. The interview went great. By the time I was a mile away from the plant, my loyal references were being called. I was summoned back the next day and received an offer of $30,000. On my first day, my immediate supervisor, Pat, introduced me to his day shift floor managers and my crew. Pat and his two managers worked with me for the next week until I got everything figured out. These were long days for all of them since they had already worked their day shift. That's the price they had to pay for turnover. The plant was divided into three sections. On the left side of the building, warehouse and maintenance. In the center, production and flash freezer. And on the right side, main freezers. In the heart of the production area was the largest conveyor fryer I had ever seen. Actually, it was the first conveyor fryer that I had ever seen. It was 6 feet wide, 5 feet high, and 25 feet long. The raw product started at one end on the conveyor, got battered and breaded, was moved into the heated oil, and came out the other end hot and crispy. From there, it snaked into the blast freezer. This room was 20 feet square and 15 feet high, with a spiral metal belt in constant motion as the fried food came in. When the product wound its way up the spiral belt, a 30 below continuous blast of air flash froze the product. As the product came out of the freezer, it was dropped into a tower packaging unit. From a central holding bin, measured portions were dropped into bags, which were sealed and sent along the belt to the line workers, who boxed them. There were other smaller production lines. Some of them consisted of battering and breading the product before it was sent in the freezer. I've always been fascinated by assembly lines in any kind of factory. I still am. Aside from turning out tons of product each day, the plant produced tons of waste. By the end of every day, it looked like a bomb went off. Specifically, our job was to clean up all the spilled oil, cornmeal, breadcrumbs, flour, and batter. It was also our job to tear apart and clean all the equipment and everything used in conjunction with the production. If you walked into the plant at 3 in the afternoon without knowing much about it and were told it had to be cleaned by 11 o'clock, you'd swear it couldn't be done. My supervisor, Pat, with his white lab coat, sporting a couple of pens and a quick-read thermometer in his top pocket, certainly looked like the epitome of professionalism. He appeared friendly and serious at the same time. After a quick howdy-do, he made his expectations of me very clear in regard to getting the plant cleaned and how my crew should be managed. I agreed with him regarding the cleanliness of the plant. Not a bad start, 1 out of 2. I learned quickly that Pat's management style was diametrically opposed to mine. For instance, he thought employee turnover was an inevitable fact of business, or fact of business, and every employee in the plant was readily expendable. He liked to point out, "This ain't no popularity contest." During our walkthrough, he pulled me aside and said, with all seriousness, "Jim, if you don't piss off at least one of your employees every day, you're not doing your job." In that regard, I thought he was very successful. I found out very soon how right I was. My style was to earn the employees' respect through being fair and loyal and giving them clear expectations. I hated turnover. The list of problems that resulted from high turnover is too long to go into. The benefits of low turnover are somewhat shorter, but very beneficial. Because I had to see Pat for only an hour each day, I didn't think that my style would clash with his, and for the most part, it didn't. After my first week of training and during my first week of being on my own, it was clear who the hard workers were and who the slackers were. I could also see that if I had to fire one or two of them, the rest of us could step up and get the job done until I replaced them. An hour into my second solo day, I pulled James aside and asked him to step outside for a few minutes. We sat across from each other at a picnic table right outside the door. I said, "James, here's the deal. I think you might be a pretty hard worker, but I haven't seen it yet, and I need to. So does everyone else on the crew. You have to make a choice. In fact, you have to make it in the next 30 seconds. If you're going to stay here, I'll be happy, because I know you're going to give me 100%. If you decide to leave, I'll still be happy, because I won't have to bother motivating you ever again. So make a choice right now. Either go back in there and get to work, or punch out and go home." He thought about it for 10 seconds and said, "I'll stay." "Good," I said. "Get back to work." I made that speech 2 more times that night. I kept 2 and lost 1. I had 7 guys in the crew, all between the ages of 18 and 25. After a few raises, the hourly rate topped out at $10 an hour. It was nasty work by any stretch of the imagination. You had to wear steel-toed, shin-high rubber boots. You sloshed and slipped around the floor in soapy water, batter, cornmeal, and oil most of the night. The work was hard and sweaty. The plant was air-conditioned, but that didn't help much. If I had been one of the workers, I wouldn't have lasted very long. For plant cleanup, they had all their ideas about which task was a good one and which one was not. So one of the first things I did was to make a list of the tasks, with the assignment of each task rotating daily in alphabetical order. I never assigned anyone anything. When they came in at the start of the shift, they'd look at the list. If they were pissed about their particular assignment for that day, the only thing they could blame was their last name and the alphabet. There was a restaurant fryer in the test kitchen. During the day, samples of the product had to be fried and tested. A month after I was there, I started a Thursday night tradition of frying a huge tray of breaded mushrooms, mozzarella sticks, onion rings, and pepper rings from the broken cases in the freezer. I served these up at 11 if they were running on time, or 10:30 if they were ahead of schedule. Why Thursday night? Friday was payday, and they were all very eager to leave. Thursdays, not so much. They would stick around and enjoy the mounds of free fried food and one another's company. Pat showed up unexpectedly one night while I was helping out the crew on the floor. Since we were one short, I had jumped into a pair of rubber boots and joined the crew cleaning up the place. Pat came up to me and asked, "What are you doing?" "Well, we're short, and I'm filling in." "No way. Your job is not to fill in and be one of the workers. Get those boots off and meet me in my office." He told me that my job was to manage the crew by walking the floor and observing. He said that I was not to do any of the physical labor. If they had to work past 11 because someone didn't show up, so be it, but it better not happen very often. And he'd better not see me filling in anymore. I didn't agree with him, but I did not want to ever get caught working again and lose my job. At my daily meeting with the crew the next day, I told them not to expect me to fill in anymore, that my job was to manage. They thought it was pretty funny that I got busted the night before, but otherwise didn't care as long as I was still doing the Thursday night feast. The more stable and trained my employees were, the less I had to watch or micromanage them. Since I could not fill in anymore, I had almost 6 hours to kill every night. I had access to a computer, so I spent the bulk of my evenings working on this book or writing emails where the occasional subject was Pat's unique personality and management style. At the end of my first month, my turnover rate dropped to zero. It stayed there for over a year. My crew liked me. They worked hard and very rarely called in sick. Since I had to be there an hour before the cleaning started, I would mingle throughout the plant, test taste some of the food, and yak with the day shift employees while they were doing the mind-numbing work of inspecting the food as it traveled along the conveyor belt. "That shit's got to stop right now." That was what Pat told me one afternoon. He went on to tell me that his crew needed to concentrate on their green pepper rings and that I was not the goddamn goodwill ambassador. He was right. We were a study in contrast. His crew hated him, he had high turnover, and he was a prick. On a quarterly basis, I had to come in with one of my employees on Saturday to help with the plant inventory. Our responsibility was the warehouse. Pat and his two floor managers were responsible for the freezers. 2 weeks prior, I had just recovered from bronchitis. When Pat showed up that morning, he said that there was going to be a slight change. I had to switch and inventory the freezer. I explained to him that I had just recovered from bronchitis and couldn't spend that kind of time in a sub-zero environment. "What?" I said, "I've been sick. I can't work in the freezers." "Are you telling me that you're refusing to do what I tell you to do?" "Yeah, I guess, if you put it that way. I'm not going to do what you want me to do. I can't. It'll probably kill me." It may have been one of the few times anyone disagreed with Pat, especially in front of his employees. He started stammering, looking around a room as if he couldn't believe this was happening, looked at both of his floor supervisors to confirm this wasn't just a bad dream, and then stalked out of the room. I'm pretty sure he went to squeal on me to the owner of the company. You would think that my stellar performance, low turnover, and consistently passing the USDA inspections would count for something. Not so. I was canned a week later. To my credit, I had been grooming my replacement for the last 6 months. Pat and the owner must have known what a smooth transition it would be if they fired me. I really hated Pat and didn't mind leaving there. I did not relish breaking the news to Julie. Good news, bad news. First, the bad. After I left, Pat recovered a floppy disk I'd accidentally left in the computer. Normally, I kept this disk with me, thus erasing my trail. In the excitement of getting fired, I forgot to retrieve it. I heard a week later how pissed Pat was, not only that I was using company time to write emails and memoirs, but that he was the negative subject in a lot of my letters. The good news? Unemployment benefits for the next 6 months. I never thought of real estate agents as salesmen. They're more like order takers. I need a house, you show me a house. I like the house, I buy it. I don't like it, you show me another. How tough could it be? I frequently saw ads for becoming a real estate agent. The training was free. The fact that I would not be getting paid a dime until I sold a house or one of my listings sold did not deter me from pursuing my new career. Plus, I was receiving unemployment benefits at the time. My training lasted 2 weeks and consisted of learning a lot of real estate stuff. I studied and passed the real estate test. I had a license to sell. Tidyman. James Tidyman. Although it didn't do me any good, I also had another swell idea. From high school to the present day, I have always enjoyed photography. By the time I arrived in Mansfield, software programs for photography were inexpensive and many were very easy to use. One day, while sitting at my computer, I played around with one of them, altering a photo of Julie's house. I made it look like a painting. Yes, a new idea. It occurred to me that new home buyers or home sellers might like artistic photo representations of their houses. The best way to reach this market would be through the real estate agents. I knew from my very brief work in real estate that agents often gave the home buyers or seller a gift of appreciation at the closing. What better gift than an artistic rendering of the new house or of the home where all those memories presided? At least that was the pitch I gave to the agents. I called my new company American Home Art. I learned how to make custom mats. I found a wholesaler for simple but stylish wooden frames. I shot a few houses, rendered them artistic, matted, framed, and gift packaged them. I set up meetings with the three largest brokers in town and presented my idea. The finished product could be delivered within days of ordering it. Total cost to the agent, $29.95. They liked it. The homes I shot for the presentation were old Victorian houses, surrounded by beautiful trees. Even without the artistic rendering, they would have looked great. Despite the fact that real estate agents as a whole have a tighter grip on their money than Hank Aaron has on a baseball bat, most of the houses I was commissioned to shoot were very boring examples of architecture. No amount of software tricks could make them otherwise. Not only did I sell very few, but most of those that I did sell were about as beautiful and aspiring as a two-story cinder block warehouse. The last one I sold got quite a reaction. The agent was closing the deal later that day. I met her at her office in the morning and presented her with the finished product. She took it out of the gift bag and said, "Oh my." I said, "Nice, huh?" "No, not exactly." "What do you mean?" She said, "Whose house is this?" Shit, I shot the wrong house. She wanted to know if I could get the right house to her later that day. I told her that wouldn't be possible because I was no longer in business. In my 6 months of unemployment from the Schneider job, I had tried and failed to sell real estate, started American Home Art business. I had no job offers. I desperately thought of other strategies to get the bills paid. I sent out at least 3 resumes a week using internet job sites. I thought that was a lot. Apparently, many industries were blind to my overall worth. Finally, I fell back on my professional driving skills and got a job at Papa John's delivering pizza. I was in the depths of despair and at the height of my stupidity. I have absolutely no sense of direction. It would have been a miracle if I made one on-time delivery of one pizza. Fortunately for me, the company, and the customers, I didn't have to. After my first day of training with Papa John's, I got a call from the temp agency wondering if I would be interested in working for a company that produced silk screens. This seemed so much less humiliating than delivering pizzas. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Regardless, I quit Papa John's. Here I was, 54, and still did not have any idea what I wanted to do for a living. I'd sunk to the point of being farmed out by a temp agency. Of course, I swallowed my pride and did the work. Sometimes I was buoyed by the thought that there could be an opportunity to rise through the ranks, to stand out from the field, to demonstrate that despite the job I was hired for, I might be someone who could take on a much higher level of responsibility and quickly rise through the ranks of a manufacturing employee. I'm serious, I really thought like that. The temp agency specialized in temporary employment assignments to the stubbornly unemployable, like me. When they called me and briefly described the silk screening job, I was somewhat optimistic, thinking that I would be immersed in an artistic work environment. Since I knew little or nothing about silk screening, I was looking forward to learning something new. So much for optimism. Schilling Graphics, my new employer, had as much to do with art as dogs have to do with typing. Many years ago, I developed the habit of showing up for my shift 10 or 30 minutes early. I like to sit in the car and relax a little before going in. If I was really early, I would set the alarm on my phone and take a short nap. I still don't understand why this little ritual made such a big difference in my workday. I would get agitated if I had not been able to find the extra time to show up early. The other benefit, of course, was that I was rarely, if ever, late. While I sat in my car that first day at Schilling Graphics, I noticed half a dozen bikes by the back door. Most of them were racing bikes in really crappy condition. Some were kids' bikes. Wow, I thought, this crew was really health conscious. After meeting the crew, I realized that this was not exactly the case. I walked in the door, right on time, of course, and asked for Rick, my boss. I was told he was in the break room. Two guys sat in the break room talking. As I looked up, I said, "Hi, my name is Jim Tidyman. I was sent here from the temp agency." Rick looked at me and said, "Great. Terry, go show him what to do." He had said great, but it sounded more like, "Great, another dipshit worthless temp." Rick looked like the character actor Lee Van Cleef. Tall, skinny, brooding, thin mustache, just like the villain in a western. I was not overly concerned about how he felt. Of course I would have liked a more gracious welcome, more in line with the vast experience, high level of skills, and unimpeachable worth ethic I was presenting. But it was no big deal. In the last year or two, my expectations of managers had dropped a notch or two with every new job. This was a good-sized plant, around 4,000 square feet. Terry gave me the 10-cent tour. Schilling Graphics was not the artsy work environment I had hoped for. It produced silk screens that were used to apply the black pinhole band across the top of automobile windshields. These black bands functioned as either sunscreens or a combination of sunscreen and antenna. Schilling Graphics shipped the finished product to Safelite, which then printed the bands on the windshields and shipped them to a nearby General Motors assembly plant. No, this did not have much to do with art. The plant was clean and well organized. I was introduced to six guys in my department. They were a rough-looking bunch, to say the least. But then, this was a manufacturing plant, not a modeling agency for Gentlemen's Quarterly. I had been in the plant 30 minutes and still had seen no one who looked inclined to compete in triathlons, let alone bike riding. I saw pot bellies, missing teeth, three-day beards, dirty fingernails, greasy hair, tattoos, ragged jeans, and one t-shirt that proclaimed, "Fear this." In short, I was rubbing shoulders with the salt of the earth, or as my pal Frank would say, the great unwashed. Before I got started with orientation, I asked Terry what was up with all the bikes out back. He explained that most of them were used by the workers who had lost their licenses because of too many DUIs, while a few guys, who didn't have cars, also rode bikes to work. Mystery solved. Tour de France? Not this year. My job was to apply clear acetate film to the finished screens in the areas not covered by the black ink. Because it required a lot of manual dexterity, it was considered the second most difficult job in the plant. Many tried, few succeeded. Little training was required. Apply the acetate. The acetate, slightly larger than the frame of silk, was a sticky-backed peel-off-the-paper sheet, like printer labels, only 2,000 times larger. The supervisor could tell within the first hour whether or not you could do the job. If you couldn't, you'd be transferred to a simpler task. Either you had the coordination for it, or you didn't. I did. The toughest job in the plant was to stretch and glue the silk to the aluminum frames. This required a lot of strength and flexibility since the guy who did the stretching had to kneel, stand, grunt, push, and pull. The trickiest part was maintaining consistent tension on the silk. The silk frames range from 8 by 10 inches to 8 by 10 feet. Most of the frames we worked were the larger ones. If the stretcher didn't get the tension right, the frame was rejected. The silk could not be reused. Way too much pressure on that job. No pun intended. I got so good at doing the plastic, as the process was called, that I caught the attention of my boss, Terry, and his boss, Lee Van Cleef, Rick. After a month, Rick called me into his office. He told me that he had noticed what a good job I had been doing was something not just anyone could handle. "Tidyman," he said, "what do you think of shillings?" I had no idea where he was going with this, but I knew what he wanted to hear. "Rick," I said, "it appears to be a fairly well-run operation. You're in a niche industry, and it doesn't appear that you have that much competition in the immediate area. I enjoy the people, Cretans, I work with. I enjoy the work, not really, and it looks as if there's room to grow here." He nodded his head after hearing this, giving me a piercing Lee Van Cleef eyeball-to-eyeball stare, and asked, "Jim, do you think you'd like to make a career out of this?" Be still my beating heart. Other than brick stacking, I couldn't think of anything I'd rather not be doing. So I said to Rick, "Yes." He nodded again and explained that Shillings had decided to buy out the last of my contract with the temp agency. I had a month to go on it. Shillings must have been afraid that if he didn't make this bold move fast, they might lose one of the best plastic guys they had in a long time. Regardless, I was somewhat flattered. On Monday, Shillings would hire me full-time. My salary would soar from $7 an hour to $9, almost a 30% raise. Not bad, but it was peanuts compared with what I had hoped I would earn. A day did not go by when Terry, my boss, didn't complain to me about the general state of temp employees, usually adding, "No offense, Jim." "None taken, Terry," I always said. He went on to explain that turnover was bad and they couldn't seem to figure out why or what to do about it. We, Terry, Rick, and I, agreed that the temp employees were costly, turnover was bad for morale, and it increased overhead and management challenges. None of this was new territory for me. I'd been in enough management situations to all have already sized up the problem and come up with a possible solution. So that's what I did. I began to put together a plan on paper of how I would be fixing the situation, at the same time implying that I was the guy who could make these much-needed changes. The owner, his last name was something unusual like Kirkenhofer, had inherited the business from his father years ago. He seemed to be doing a good job. Production was high and, from what I could tell, profitable. Kirkenhofer looked the part in his $300 suit and styled hair. In the 2 months I'd been there, I'd seen him every other day as he walked through the plant. I'm sure I said hi to him once in a while, but there was no reason for him to chat with me. It took me a few days to put together my master plan. The gist of it was, stop using temp employees, design a more comprehensive interview process, and raise the starting salary to a level that was 20% higher than minimum wage. The topper was to start a second shift, which the company said it had been considering for more than a year. I was ready to explain the many benefits that would accrue to the company, the workforce, the morale, and of course, the bottom line. In the middle of the afternoon, making sure that Kirkenhofer was in his office, I knocked on his door and he motioned me in. I introduced myself and told him a little bit about my experience as it related to Shillings. I handed him the plan along with one of my semi-fictitious resumes and asked him politely if he would take the time to review them. He didn't ask me a thing. He acknowledged that I worked for him by saying, yeah, I've seen you out on the floor. He thanked me and said he would. Nothing happened for 2 weeks. I wasn't worried. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. But I was surprised it took so long to get some feedback. 2.5 weeks later, Lee Van Cleef came out on the floor and told me as soon as I was done applying the piece of plastic to the silk screen, Kirkenhofer wanted to see me in the conference room. I finished the screen, washed my hands, tucked in my shirt, and headed down the hall. Van Cleef and Kirkenhofer were seated in the conference room. They greeted me and asked me to sit down. "Jim," said Kirkenhofer, "first I have to tell you that we really liked your plan. Naturally, we were aware of some of the things you brought up. Your presentation makes sense, and based on what we see on your resume, we want you to implement it. Inwardly, I smiled. Outwardly, uncommitted. In short, he continued, we'd like you to be the assistant to human resources and head up the hiring as it pertains to the plant floor. In addition, we'd like you to help out in inventory control, quality control, and customer service. I had become so used to accepting amazingly wonderful news or devastatingly shitty news with a deadpan look that I had to remind myself that at this moment I should be happy. Geez, I said. Yeah, that's great. Kirchenhofer explained I would start this new job Monday morning and my salary would be? I expected him to offer $25,000 with an increase after 3 months based on performance. But he said $37,000. Great, I responded. I accept. We shook hands all around. Even Van Cleef smiled. A little. As I left, Kirchenhofer added, Tidyman, one more thing. My stomach flipped. Shit, fuck, damn, I thought. Now what? Terry will supervise the new second shift. Both Terry and Mike will report to you. Uh-oh, this is a very bad idea. Terry and Mike had 19 and 17 years respectively on the job. I should have stopped right there and said, how about we do everything as planned except I report to Terry and Mike? If I had said that, and they had agreed, would I still be there? Probably not, but I would have lasted a hell of a lot longer than I did. Later that day, I talked to Terry and Mike. They had already learned about the new plan. I hope that reporting to me won't be a problem, I said. I know both you guys have so much more experience working here. I want you to know, I really respect that. No, no, Jim, Terry lied. No problem at all, Jim, Mike lied. We're happy to see you get promoted, Terry lied again. I set the plan in motion, got the second shift up and running, started interviewing prospective plant workers, upgraded the level of personnel, and started the company on the road to greater profits and lower turnover. I wasn't as successful with quality control, inventory control, and customer service. If I had been answering to Terry and Mike instead of the other way around, they might have been more helpful in teaching me something about the business and the inventory needs. Not only did they not help me, but every time there was a problem, when inventory delayed production, these two idiots were first in the let's screw old Jim line. How do I know this? One of the secretaries kept me informed. We maintained a silk inventory of some 400 different textures, lengths, colors, sizes, and applications. Even for someone with a lot of experience, this would have been challenging. It baffled me most of the time, and I didn't know how to defend myself when my secretary Mole reported, Jim, Mike told Kirchenhofer, that if it hadn't been for your latest inventory screw-up, we wouldn't have had to hold up production all week. Or, Jim, you should know this, Mike told Kirchenhofer he couldn't believe you were so stupid as to miss the order on the number 2 silk. Thanks, guys. After 3 months of my screwing up inventory control, Kirchenhofer gave me a choice. Go back to applying plastic, or adios. I should have quit and started collecting unemployments again. Holding me back was the image of Julie's face and the look in her eyes when I walked in the back door and announced that once again I was out of work. The little enthusiasm I had when I first joined Shillings as a plastic man was all but gone on this second go-around. They demoted me from my former position and cut my salary back to $9 an hour. It was impossible for me to give the work, the focus, the dexterity, and attention to detail it required. After a few costly mistakes, Terry, my new boss and former underling, showed me the door. I didn't relish telling Julie about this latest development, but again, I was not overly anxious. It was not because it had happened before. I just think I was resigned to the fact that I hadn't screwed up on purpose. Shit happens. I was already depressed. I didn't feel like adding anxiety to the mix. I went from $7 an hour to $9 an hour to $37,000 a year and then back to $9 an hour to getting fired, all in 6 months. Unfortunately, right after the raise to $37,000, I had financed a car for $275 a month for 2 years. As you may imagine, I was getting tired of working and the ugly reality of trying to find another job really sucked the wind out of me. I didn't have any more entrepreneurial ideas. I wished that all those ads for work at home or how to make $1 million buying foreclosures with no cash up front were actually real. My new unemployment benefits were just enough to pay my share of the rent and not miss a car payment. I even think I had enough left over to pay for groceries. So from that point of view, I had managed to keep from becoming a total slug. My best friend Frank and his wife were in Hawaii at the time. They were rebuilding a dressage horse ranch they bought. Since Frank knew I could get away for a while, he suggested that he fly me to Hawaii for a couple of weeks to help with labor. I gave it about 15 seconds of thought and said, "Aloha, dude. I'm a hard worker. Ask almost anyone." I knew that despite the labor I was going to put in on the horse ranch, hanging out with my best friend while doing grunt work in Maui would be considerably more enjoyable than weathering the climate at home. My reception in Maui was just what I expected. Frank and Donna were glad to see me. We spent that afternoon and evening drinking and eating. The next morning, I started working. Frank had already been there for a month. The condition of this horse ranch was such that it didn't look like much progress had been made. Years of debris needed to be hauled out. In fact, it looked as if the whole place had to be rebuilt. Even with the balmy, constant light breeze, it didn't take long to work up a good sweat. I spent the next 3 or 4 days working my butt off for 8 to 10 hours a day. Despite the honest labor, real sweat, and a semblance of progress, trouble was brewing with Frank's wife, Donna. Turns out she was getting bored while all this physical labor was going on. She suggested to Frank that my presence would be just as beneficial, if not more so, if I were to accompany her on a daily basis and do as the tourists do, have fun. Who was I to argue? For that matter, who was Frank to argue? It was a win-win-win situation. Each successive day brought a very pleasant routine. The three of us got up, and we either went out for breakfast or I cooked in. We dropped Frank off at the ranch, and Donna and I hit the trail. Donna and I did all the regular touristy things, like driving up to the top of a volcano crater, finding a new place to eat lunch, touring the sugarcane factory, inspecting the pineapple groves, bar hopping on the beach, mat surfing, hiking up the rainforest mountain trail, and more. There was a lot to do on Maui, and we were just the two to do it. Much to Frank's delight, we were out of his hair for the day. Around 5 o'clock, we'd pick him up and head to the closest watering hole and restaurant, or go home with that evening's provisions. I'm a good cook. They look forward to my whipping up dinner. I did not fail them. This went on for almost 3 weeks. For some reason, while I was there, I carried on as if all this were normal. I didn't give much thought to when I'd be going home, unemployed and with no prospects. I think that I have spent so much of my life not worrying about things that I can keep the dismal future from screwing up my pleasant present. When I got back to Mansfield, I still had 4 months of unemployment coming to me. Nothing makes time go faster than a date with debt. I continued to send out resumes and checked every source that posted employment opportunities. When I did get an interview, I couldn't keep my convoluted resume straight. I recall 2 occasions when I sent a prospective employer my resume. By the time 2 weeks went by and I got called in for an interview, I might have produced a different resume for another prospect. During the interview, the company rep might ask me to go through my job history, highlighting my responsibilities and accomplishments. I had one resume in my hand, he had another. I knew I was instantly in trouble when I got halfway into a job summary and the rep flipped his resume to the back looking for the job I was talking about. After a few befuddled seconds, he said just that, "Mr. Tidyman, what job are you talking about?" I instantly knew what was wrong. Shit, wrong resume. I slowly got up, stowed my resume, shook his hand, thanked him for his time, and headed for the door. You can recover from a faux pas once in a while in an interview, but getting caught lying is not one of them. By now, my self-esteem was so low, I couldn't imagine why anyone would hire me. My heart condition and resulting lack of energy were such that there were fewer and fewer jobs I would be physically qualified for. For instance, anything that required physical exertion, standing, sitting, or typing for long periods was out. What was left? Within the next 4 months, Frank and Donna were done with the ranch in Maui. And I mean really done. It was such a financially and emotionally draining ordeal that when they finished it, all they wanted to do was sell it and never go back to Hawaii. I felt I was at a dead end in Ohio. It was hard to argue the opposite. I knew Julie was tired and embarrassed by my ricochet employment. She even suggested that maybe my pal Frank could put me to work. Be careful what you wish for. Frank and I were on the phone one day, exchanging tales of woe, mine, when he suggested that I come back to Florida. He said he didn't know what, but figured that there was some fledgling operation he could finance and I could run. What a friend. Much to Julie's surprise, I took him up on the offer.